It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in on broadband rollout at the tip of Door County, Washington Island, with about 700 year-round residents accessible only by ferry. Call with your questions about the new fiber optic on capabilities on the island. Share your experiences with high-speed internet access in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Robert Cornell is manager of the Washington Island Electric Cooperative. Robert, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, good morning. Get us up to speed on how the fiber optic network project is going.
Well, it's actually progressing fairly well. I mean, considering the fact that the world has got supply chain issues and a lot of people are doing broadband right now, we've been able to move forward. We're going to probably hit a hard stop here on our progress as the weather stops us, but we are connecting people every day.
When you say you're connecting people every day, what are the numbers you're looking at? What is this progress?
Well, we're going to serve every single member of the Washington Island Electric Cooperative. We're not just passing people like most internet service providers talk about. We're actually bringing the service to the home. Of course, it's up to them whether they want to subscribe to the service or not, but we expect that we'll have a pretty good take rate on the island. Under this current grant round that we're working on, we have 314 homes that we're going to bring the fiber to. And again, like I said, getting into the houses, that's up to the individual member. But so far, we haven't had anybody that's really told us, no, we don't want the service.
What is timeline like for full access to the whole island?
When we started this project, we set it up as five phases. We're the smallest cooperative in the state and one of the smallest in the country. So our resources are limited. So we looked at a five-year rollout. So depending on grant funding, of course, that rollout could happen much faster. So the number of meters that we have is around 1,100 meters. And we expect to have all of those connected, or at the very least have a network interface device on their home or business by the end of 5 years.
Why install fiber optic rather than another internet service method like satellite?
Well, first of all, satellite is not accessible to everybody due to terrain and tree cover. And we do have a lot of those sort of issues on the island. The co-op has really kind of dabbled in broadband since about 2005. We initially did a broadband over the power lines project, which was actually fairly successful. We had about 30% of our members as subscribers. Unfortunately, the ISP that we were working with, they went under, and we ended up working with Frontier Communications to assist them with an installation of DSL on the island. At one point, they were about 500 customers, but again, there's some pretty serious limitations as far as what's available and what the actual definition of broadband is with both of those. Both of those services as well as the satellite services. So fiber really is the only way to go. We looked at a fiber project in about 2015 with Insight, which is the parent company for Cellcom, but the economics just didn't work out. And then we had a submarine cable failure that kind of put us in a bad position from an electric standpoint, but also put us in the position to run fiber across Death's Door, which is the passage that runs to Washington Island. So that became a natural to connect to their loop.
Talking with Robert Cornell of the Washington Island Electric Cooperative about this new fiber optic network project, the five-year project underway. Region sits just off the northeast tip of Door County. You can join in on broadband and the rollout in your community. What you want to know about Washington Island's approach, 800-642-1234. So I wonder, how did you make the economics work out this time? I mean, installing a fiber optic network, very costly, as you know. How did Washington Island secure the funding to complete this project?
Well, again, the biggest roadblock was that, 4.5 mile straight that you have to cross in order to get here. Mm-hmm. our cable runs at about 160 feet of water in some places.
Mm.
And because we had to replace the power cable that came here, we were able to actually manufacture the power cable with fiber in it, which then really opened the door to get us, to get us where we are today. One of the things that's helped us is obviously we, as the electric co-op, we own the infrastructure on Washington Island. So we don't have a lot of, we control the make ready costs, which is pole loading and clearances and all that sort of stuff in order to go overhead with fiber. And then we partnered with Insight Teleservices out of Pulaski, which is the parent company for Cellcom, and connected to their loop. And then they also were able to help us with the project because they're able to get fiber backhaul to their cell tower on the island, which improves cellular service as well. So there's been a lot of affordability issues, that we've had to look at. We've been very lucky to receive a grant in partnership, a couple grants in partnership with Insight, and now a grant with the ARPA funding on our own. And we're going to continue to file for grants, but our estimated cost, it does work economically, even if we don't get a grant. We'll just have some significant debt if we don't get grants.
What is the estimated cost in a project that could take until 2027 to complete? And, you're digging fiber, under death's door.
Yeah, well, the fiber's already under death's door.
Okay.
So that's that occurred as part of the cable replacement.
Sure.
And that really was a nominal cost increase to build the cable in order to get under death's door. So that's been a pretty good deal. But about a $6 million project would be my guess. When we initially looked at it in 2018, 2019, we were talking about a $4 to $5 million project, but again, inflation has hit and supply chain issues have hit, and everybody and their brother is trying to do fiber right now. So that's going to drive up costs of materials and also the availability of contractors.
When you say supply chain, what specific issues are holding back projects like yours?
Well, the ability to, there was a resin shortage for the production of fiber optic cable. There also was there's shortages in splitter cabinets. Right down to the split bolts and the machine bolts and the hardware to hang it on the poles. It's everything is slower than it was.
You mentioned grants, a couple grants, and Wisconsin receiving CARES Act and ARPA funds that have gone toward broadband. How has Washington Island benefited from the federal pandemic dollars?
Well, the grants that we've received were actually Public Service Commission grant programs. The initial two that we received, one for putting the fiber under death's door, and that was working with Insight. And then the other grant was to get the backbone to the Insight tower and then connect 25 people along that backbone. That was again Public Service Commission money. It wasn't CARES Act. But now we've been the beneficiary of a ARPA grant, the pandemic grant, that's about $1 million. But of course, there's matches that have to go along with that. So we're about a 40% match on that grant.
Where do you find the match money?
Well, we have lenders and we've run the economics and we're able to borrow money in order to do that.
Really want to ask you, can people access high speed internet while on board the ferry to Washington Island?
Not at the moment, unless they're connecting to cellular. However,
okay.
There is, we are talking about the possibility of doing some wireless connectivity, going across death's door, because we obviously have service on the mainland right at the ferry dock and also have it here on the island at the ferry dock as well. So that's in the thought process, but we want to get people's homes connected first before we worry about whether somebody can be looking at their phone rather than looking at the scenery as they cross death's door.
Understandable. Point taken. Robert Cornell manages Washington Island Electric Cooperative. As we learn about getting high-speed internet to a self-contained community at the tip of Door County, call in with your questions about broadband expansion. Share your thoughts on high-speed internet in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the story of high-speed internet access in a remote and breathtaking location in Wisconsin, Washington Island at the tip of Door County. The Washington Island Electric Co-op, the island's electric provider, overseeing this five-year fiber optic network project. Be part of the conversation, calling with your questions about Washington Island's model, its approach. Your comments are welcome, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Robert Cornell, manager of the Washington Island Electric Cooperative, stays with us. So in October, Washington Island School became the first to receive a high-speed internet connection. What do the higher speeds now mean for educators and students? What do you hear?
Well, prior to that time, the school had a BadgerNet connection that was over microwave, which was necessarily limited because I think they would get about a 30 meg connection, which was probably one of the fastest connections on Washington Island. However, now they've got a 1 gig connection, which means that you can have a classroom full of students all on their devices and not create an issue for access, which was an issue in the past.
What will this mean for economic development, for, you know, your businesses in the community?
Well, there's I guess, several aspects of that. First of all, I mean, with the amount of money that we're spending, whether we get grants or not, we've really made a conscious effort to try and spend that money locally, or at least as local as possible. So we're working with a company out of Sturgeon Bay, Quantum PC Services, to do our splicing and to help with our home installs. And that has actually led them to purchase a piece of property on the island where they will open a storefront at some point during this project. So that's not only keeping the money local, but it's also pretty pure economic development from that standpoint. They've done a great job for us. We also have tried to keep as much of the contractor work, at least as local to Northeast Wisconsin, as is practical. And then, again, as far as the economic development, we're largely a tourist oriented community. So our economy is based on visitors to the island. And if we're able to get some of these unoccupied seasonal homes occupied year round, that's a pretty natural economic development that's not tourism based. And if people can work from home and live where they want to live, that's a huge plus.
Do you find that there might be better responsive relationships when you do sign contracts with these companies that are in the community or in Sturgeon Bay or local contractors?
Well, yeah, I think that they appreciate the fact that we've kept it local. And again, it's also keeping this money in the local area. So yeah, they're very happy to be working here.
You talked about the Public Service Commission grants, and now they're accepting applications for the next round through the Broadband Expansion Grant Program. People can apply until February 22nd. Are you really trying to maximize those grants, and what will that mean for this project? And what about writing and processing this type of grant paperwork?
Well, that's sort of sits on my desk, which is covered with lots of paperwork. But we're a pretty small operation. So yes,
I imagine you wear many hats.
yeah. We're a small operation, and we did have a fair amount of help from Insight on the first two grants, which we partnered on. However, this last grant I wrote and submitted, and we are going to be applying in this. This particular grant round, it's not a very large amount of money. It's $14 million. It's leftover Universal Service Fund money that they're cleaning up prior to the BEAD funding, which is coming later this fall.
Mm-hmm. And again, BEAD standing for Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program.
Mm-hmm. Yep, correct. Again, it's, the money that we've gotten is as you know, we've kind of taken the attitude that we'd like to get as much of our great grandchildren's money as we possibly can and spend it on something that's going to benefit our great grandchildren. We feel that that's the right thing to do. So we will continue to pursue every grant opportunity we can. But any grant, regardless of how good the project is pie in the sky, which usually means somebody threw a pie at you. We hope to get more funding from grant money, but we also are moving forward regardless.
Do you have any advice on the grant process, on grant writing and submission in the broadband arena, since you've been successful at it here in the past?
Honestly, I really think that the public-private partnership portion of that is very important. Support from the local community, the local governmental agencies. We did apply for a NTIA, which is the National Telecommunications and Information Agency, which is part of the Department of Commerce on a federal level, that we did not get. However, we did have the local school district, the town, the county, and we also had a letter of coordination from the state. So we've had great support from all our government bodies, which really lends itself well to a public-private partnership. And then just getting the people in the community to sound off about their enthusiasm about the project is very important as well.
Talking about broadband access with Robert Cornell of the Washington Island Electric Cooperative, the region is working to build this new fiber optic network, years in the making. You can join in your questions about how this community is doing it, how your community is building out connectivity. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You know, Robert, one of the things that we've heard from the Public Service Commission, we've heard in our past conversations here recently, is about the FCC really coming out with this new national broadband map data that is really supposed to tell us exactly where it is accessible, where it's not. Do you think the coverage data adequately reflects Washington Island?
It absolutely does not. There are still a huge number of inaccuracies in the FCC maps. There has been a challenge process that is in itself a challenge for people to individually challenge it. There's inclusion of some services that really don't meet the criteria for broadband, and there's also a lot of inaccurate information in it. So that's a difficult thing to be positive about. I think that the map is improved from what it once was. But it's also the FCC maps are very, very inaccurate in my opinion.
Why would the data be so off, so lacking?
Well, there's number one, there's internet service providers have overstated what they are capable of providing, and that information is still in the maps. For example, we have some locations here on the island that due to proximity to the phone service, they say they're capable of 70 megabyte service. The radio that microwaves is capable of 40 megabytes max, and it's shared. So again, that information is not accurate. And again, they also have included some satellite data that's not accessible to everybody. So it's a difficult thing to get a handle on. I think it's better than it was, but it's still very inaccurate, and it just requires accurate data.
So you did submit a challenge on that map.
The challenges that were available were individual challenges. I believe that the Wisconsin State Telephone Association submitted a challenge. Mm. And I believe that NRECA, which is our national organization, the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, was working on a challenge as well. Individual challenges were not particularly easy. The meter that I have showed that I was served. However, when I went in to try and do an individual challenge on that, I was actually unable to do it. And I may not be the most tech savvy person, but I certainly can find my way around. And it just wasn't easy.
Well, in our final moments together here, as our state sits on this historic budget surplus, what should state lawmakers know about building internet infrastructure into the future?
Well, one thing I think everybody already knows is that even with the dramatic amount of money that is coming through that BEAD program, it's not going to be enough to do all of rural Wisconsin. So there's going to have to be some pretty hard pencil sharpening in order to figure out where that money is going to come from so that every single person is served. There's a lot of, in the past, there's been cherry picking on the part of internet service providers, and that's been based on economics, not necessarily criticizing them for that, but it means that people out in the hinterland like Washington Island were not served, and we've got to figure out a way to serve everyone.
Robert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Robert Cornell is manager of the Washington Island Cooperative. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the State of the State speech. Each year, the governor gives the State of the State address to the legislature, and we unpack the themes from last night's primetime speech. Your reaction to Governor Tony Evers' first State of the State of his second term in office. Call in with your questions, your observations, what you heard, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sean Johnson is here, Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate.
Hi. So I heard you call last night a mini budget address from Governor Evers. What made it feel that way to you?
Yeah, you know, some State of the State addresses are strictly cheerleading or kind of broad themes, look ahead. If it's an election year, you know, you'll hear a governor kind of lay out their platform in that way. I think with this speech and with this budget coming in about a month and with this massive budget surplus that the governor's going to have to work with here, he had just no shortage of material of stuff he wants to kind of start talking about now. And so you heard him mention, you know, very specific dollar figures for programs that are going to be in his budget. He talked about $270 million for student mental health, $100 million to address PFAS, 20% of the state's sales tax revenue for local governments. Kind of list goes on and on. So while not a thorough, complete budget address that tells you how the whole thing's going to work, he gave a lot of sneak peeks into the budget he's going to introduce next month.
And he ended his speech with some motivational words about working together with the legislature. Let's hear his final words.
If we are inspired, not by power, but by partnership, if we are dedicated, not to selfish interests, but to self-sacrifice, if we can forge new paths, not through conflict, but through collaboration, then together we will.
So how does the governor plan to bring Democrats and Republicans together to advance policy?
I don't know. I mean, if you just looked at last night's speech and the reaction is kind of a microcosm of state government, they're not together on anything he mentioned in his speech. I think there was pretty much a 0% applause rate from the Republican side of the aisle for the governor's speech. So the relationship that existed in his first term between, you know, him, his office, and Republican leaders of the legislature still very much exists. Although I will say there is at least one area, I'll say, where it's a big picture item when the governor's talking about shared revenue. You know, it does seem like Republicans and the governor might work together on that.
And let's,
as far as the overall mood in the legislature, I'm not so sure.
Let's hear that moment on shared revenue to local governments, like really dramatically changing how they are funded and getting a standing ovation in the parlor after saying this.
I'm announcing tonight that I will work together on a budget provision that will send a total of up to 20% of the state's sales tax revenue back to our local communities for shared revenue.
So up to 20% of the state's sales tax revenue. What does that look like for communities?
We don't have the fine details of the proposal yet, but if you just kind of take the summary that the governor laid out for us last night, assuming that it's basically, you know, on the broad strokes correct, he says it's going to be $500 million more annually for Wisconsin communities. So shared revenue. That is a substantial investment. And I think also the fact that he would be talking about taking a percentage of the state's sales tax revenue and dedicating that to local governments is significant. It's more significant than if he just said, here's a dollar figure that we're going to devote to them, because then the dollar figure could just sit there in future budgets. You know, lawmakers are not under an obligation to increase it every budget necessarily. Whereas if it's a percentage, it grows as the state's economy grows. So that would be certainly something that would be a big political win for Wisconsin counties, cities, local governments. I'm not sure where Republicans are on that specifically,
because
but they didn't criticize it in the way that they did with other provisions.
We've heard them floating, you know, designated, I think, 1% of state sales tax to replace shared revenue. I mean, what might compromise look like on shared revenue? What might Republicans think of this?
I am not sure what the compromise will look like, but I can tell you that I'm just used to, after a governor's speech like this, if he, at this governor and this legislature, when he introduced a big proposal like this that would spend a substantial amount of money, the stock response, the consistent response from Republican leaders has been, you know, we can't afford it. It's too expensive. He's spending, you know, state taxpayer money too freely. They didn't say, we love the governor's shared revenue plan after this speech, but they said, we're talking, and that they are looking at it. And they have kind of acknowledged that local governments have had to face inflationary pressures like everybody else right now, and that paying local bills is becoming too much for some local governments. So it really does sound like the kind of issue where there could be an agreement between Republicans and Evers. I think if that happens, though, it's not going to be the kind of thing where Evers announces it in the speech and Republican leaders come back and say, yeah, we like that. I think they would all have to claim some kind of victory in the final product.
Does Evers being, you know, in a second term have any impact here on his influence with members across the aisle?
I think that's still an open question. We're so early in the term. You could imagine that it might. It was his first term. You got the sense that Republicans viewed it as sort of a four-year blip, that you know, they felt that they were going to have a Republican governor to work with in the year 2023. And that's not the case. Evers won by a larger margin than he did in his first election. He is, you know, by every definition, a legitimate governor who's going to be around for a while. So it may affect this term in ways that we don't yet know compared to the first term. You have seen the Senate start to, you know, forward some of his appointees to various committees for consideration. So the Senate has to confirm the governor's appointees. Those appointees can serve without Senate confirmation. But, you know, the typical way that things would happen is the Senate would confirm these people. They hadn't been doing that in the governor's first term. They've at least taken that step to saying, with many of these appointees, we're going to consider these now. So that looks like a tangible sign where things are a little different, a little more functional than they were in Evers' first term.
Getting analysis and context about Governor Tony Evers' State of the State address in prime time last night, Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief, our guide. You can join in on what you heard from the speech, your observation, your takeaways, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to after the governor's speech. We heard from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss delivering an official Republican response.
Now, don't get me wrong. Republicans understand costs are rising for our local schools and local governments, just like they are for our families. Government must do things differently if we have any hope of keeping our tax burden heading in the right direction.
So do things differently. How do the Republican priorities this response? What did you hear from it?
I think their boss may be alluding to kind of what he wants to see if the state's going to do something different for local governments with shared revenue. And he has a lot of ideas that he shared on the topic, including in Milwaukee, he wants to see, you know, more shared services potentially, it sounds like,
from the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. His big mantra since the election, Voss's big refrain has been that I want to see some kind of reform. And of course, that word's always in the eye of the beholder, but some kind of reform before we just give new revenue. So I think whatever that ends up being, he wants to see local governments or the state government come his way in some way before he okays any new state dollars going to them.
And he has said before how he wants the new budget to cut taxes significantly more than the current 2-year budget. So where did the state of the state take us on tax relief?
Yeah, the governor talked about that in a couple different ways. One, he said that this idea that some Republicans, namely Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux, have been talking about with a flat tax, where all taxpayers, regardless of their income, are taxed at the same rate. Evers said that is a no-go, basically. He kind of politely said, I'm not going to support anything that just, digs us in a hole for future budgets, leads to potential spending cuts in future budgets because we can't afford the tax cut. So that is something that the governor has drawn at this point a pretty firm line on, and that he won't support what's known as a flat tax. He says he will have a tax cut in his budget, but that it'll be responsible. In the past, he's talked about a middle class tax cut. Voss is saying, though, and Lemieux is saying, that our budget starts with the tax cut. That's what we want to do most. And so we're going to decide on that and how big it is, and we'll build the rest of the budget from there, which is a different starting point from Evers, who has said, I want to start with like $2 billion more for schools, and then we'll start from that point.
2023, year of mental health. What did you take away from that focus of the speech?
Yeah, the governor in several of his speeches since he's been elected has declared it the year of something. You know, the year of water.
Clean water.
The year of broadband, I think, was one of them.
Yep.
But mental health, it's not. That's not like necessarily a re-election, you score lots of political points by running on mental health. This is a governor who's won a first term, and he is really focused on this issue, and in a big, substantial way, too. He's talking about $500 million total for mental health, including $270 million for mental health directed at young people. That is... It's a substantial new investment in the world of state government. And, you know, just based on what Republicans were saying after the speech, I don't know that they're going to go that high. I mean, Speaker Voss hinted as much, and then later on Twitter, when he was talking about it, said it's not going to happen, basically. So there could be some money in the budget that they pass that goes toward mental health, but, you know, I don't know how they're going to, square things away with the governor on that one.
Sean Johnson is WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. Call in with your questions, your thoughts about state politics. The number to call is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're catching up on state politics with WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, our guide. Still time to talk. Join our conversation on state politics. Call with your questions, your observations, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Sean, last week we saw the bipartisan group of state lawmakers advancing this proposed constitutional amendment giving judges the ability to set higher bail amounts. That proposal now appearing on spring ballots for a statewide referendum. Explain what would need to happen next to amend the Constitution.
Really, the last step on this one is that it is up to the voters, and that if the voters pass these referendums that are going to be on the ballot in April, the referendum question on bail, then that's it. The Constitution is amended, because to get here, the last legislature passed this resolution, the last legislature being, you know, the one that met in the years 2021 and 2022. And then we have a new session of the legislature that just convened in January. They passed the identical resolution in the Senate and the Assembly. That sends it to voters, and it's up to voters now. If they say yes, we amend the Constitution. If they say no, the whole process has to start back over again.
What does Governor Evers support in the process of setting bail?
I'm not sure where he's at on the specific wording of this question, but in this case, because it's a proposed amendment to the Constitution, it sidesteps the governor. It's not something where, you know, we're used to this dynamic in state government where anytime Republican lawmakers pass something that's somewhat controversial, if it's a bill, it's got to go to the governor. You kind of know what's going to happen. He is probably going to veto it. He's out of the process when it comes to a resolution like this or a constitutional amendment like this. So it's really just the legislature and the public that that get to weigh in on this. And, typically I think Republicans feel like when it comes to a measure that I think you would say fits in their wheelhouse of sort of tough on crime proposals, they like their odds with that, but it's really, you know, it's up to voters.
We also saw Republican lawmakers advancing this advisory referendum to ask voters if the state should require able-bodied, childless adults to look for work to receive welfare payments. We heard Voss allude to that as well last night. Democrats oppose scheduling the referendum. And let's hear Democratic State Senate Minority Leader Melissa Agard.
Advisory referendums are supposed to do just that, advise. So the people are going to advise lawmakers on something that is already the law in the state of Wisconsin. That only makes sense if you're looking at the world through a cynical and political lens.
Sean, why are lawmakers creating this advisory referendum on work requirements?
Well, I guess Republicans are saying that they want to hear from the public on an issue, and it's important to get the public's point of view on this. Democrats, including Senate Minority Leader Melissa Agard, are saying this is pretty transparent political ploy here, that you already do require the people to perform work searches to receive public benefits like unemployment insurance. The state does not require it for something like Medicaid, though, although that is not entirely in the state's hands. You're dealing with what's permitted by the federal government there and what's permitted by the federal court system when it comes to a federal program like Medicaid. But one reason you do see advisory referendums get put on the ballot, it happens from time to time, especially at the local level, is it gives people something else to turn out for other than whatever else is on the ballot. You know, people might not be interested in lower turnout races, but they might have opinions about, you know, what you're going to do with, you know, the way that the resolution frames it, you know, using, you know, funds for welfare.
Is there evidence that ballot measures boost turnout for a party?
I think you could go, you would probably depend on the measures, but I do know that we have a lot of them and they're often pretty political in nature. You know, so like in a county that wants to boost Democratic turnout, for example, and normally this happens at the local level where a county board will pass a resolution and get voters at the local level to weigh in and stuff. So, you know, they might ask, do you favor legalizing marijuana for recreational purposes, or do you favor nonpartisan redistricting, or, you know, you just kind of go on and on down the list of, you know, issues that we might have talked about in a given day. And I think you'd want to talk to a proper political scientist on whether there's actual hard evidence of elections where these things work. But I think that people who are professional vote getters feel like they work enough that they keep trying them. And that is what the legislature is doing here with this resolution for the April election, when we are going to be electing a state Supreme Court justice. that could tip the ideological balance of the court from conservative to liberal for the first time since 2008. So it's just a monumental election. And I'm not sure that, you know, given the sort of the stakes of the election and how much money is going to be spent on it, I'm not sure how many people are going to be going to the voting booth and saying, well, I really want to weigh in on this advisory referendum. But it is sort of a tool at the legislature's disposal to get the public to turn out and vote and speak their mind. It also, I would say, as they get in sort of this PR battle, they, the Republican legislature with the governor, he will often say about his policy agenda, look, the public is with me on all these issues, Medicaid expansion, you know, gun control, marijuana legalization, look at the polling numbers. So this could be a way for the legislature to say, well, look at this. We sent this something we support to the voters and they approved it in this advisory referendum if that's what happens.
Should we be keeping our eyes peeled? Are there other potential measures waiting in the wings to get on the April ballot?
They won't have enough time to get other stuff at the statewide level on the April ballot. Okay. But I do wonder if this is the start of a trend for Republican legislators who, for certainly at least the next 4 years, are in a situation where they're dealing with the Democratic governor and maybe they start doing these advisory referendums more. It's for as easy as it is for the legislature to put these things on the ballot, they haven't done it a whole lot, but maybe that's changing.
And, you know, very quickly here, as we wrap up, we have seen, you know, state Senate Democrats really trying to push the advisory referendum that would ask voters about overturning the state's abortion ban. Is that headed anywhere with Republican lawmakers?
That is not going to be on the ballot as long as Republican lawmakers are controlling the legislature, which, you know, they will be doing for at least the foreseeable future. But it's not going to stop Democrats from talking about it because they feel like, I mean, they've looked at polling and the majority of the public is with them on this issue. And also it is an issue that motivates the Democratic base in a big way, as we saw in 2022. So even though it's a losing cause in the state legislature, as long as Republicans are running the legislature in Wisconsin, it's something you're going to hear a lot about from Democrats, including in the run-up to that April Supreme Court election, where abortion really could be decided in substantial ways by the next state Supreme Court.
Sean, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. And just a heads up, if you want to listen to those speeches last night, the State of the State, the Republican response in their entirety, go to pbswisconsin.org. They're right there. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.